hingehört und nachgefragt. Informationen und Kritik zu Fortpflanzungs- und Gentechnologie. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Hingehört und Nachgefragt, dem Podcast des Genethischen Netzwerks. Heute geht es ganz grob gesagt um Verantwortung von NaturwissenschaftlerInnen. Über dieses Thema haben Isabel Bartram und Janina Johansen vom Genethischen Netzwerk mit dem belgischen Professor für Bioinformatik Yves Moreau gesprochen, auch diesmal wieder auf Englisch. Eine deutsche Übersetzung des Interviews werden wir demnächst auf unserer Webseite veröffentlichen. Den Link dazu findet ihr wie immer in den Shownotes. Yves Moreau setzt sich seit Jahren für die Einhaltung ethischer Standards in der genetischen Forschung ein und wurde vor kurzem dafür von der Einstein-Stiftung ausgezeichnet. Bekannt ist er vor allem für seine Kritik an unethischer Forschung an unterdrückten chinesischen Minderheiten. Das Gespräch ist dieses Mal etwas lang geraten, denn die genetische Forschung führt uns zum Wert von DNA-Daten und der Frage nach Privatsphäre, zu den kapitalistischen Zwängen im Wissenschaftssystem und der Macht der Verlagshäuser, bis letztendlich zu der Frage, ob WissenschaftlerInnen politisch sein dürfen. Bis zum Ende hören lohnt sich, das können wir versprechen. Und jetzt viel Spaß.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for coming here to our little office and studio. And
Berlin is a great place. I love being here.
Great. So we met last week at Republica. You had this quite inspiring talk about, I have to read it to not mix the title up, Dubious Sources Investigating the Dark Side of Large Human DNA Database, which is basically one of the topics we also work with. And therefore, I'm really happy that we have you here today.
So yeah, thank
we
you
can
so
talk
much.
About it. Well, you are a scientist and you do some critical research in the interface between AI, artificial intelligence, and genetics. And well, just in general for our audience, first question would be, why is DNA data privacy important at all?
All right. That's a large question to start with. I mean, there's different aspects in different contexts. So I think that for me, working in my research on clinical genetic data, and there is, let's say, the more Western concerns about privacy, where we are handling data from patients, that data can contain information about serious genetic disorders, some of them having a stigmatizing dimension. For example, things linked to mental health or certain disorders that, for example, affect your physiognomy and how you look and where people, of course, react to that. So this is information that very early on I realized that there was a balance to be found between the fact that the patients and their families, because often what we look at are kids, they want to get answers. They want us to share the data overwhelmingly so that we can get answers to all the clinical issues surrounding these diseases, and in particular just the cause, finding the mutation that causes a certain disease. But of course, that information is clearly sensitive, and so it's not okay to just say, okay, we're going to put everything on a big pile, open up to scientists or everybody else in the world who may want to look at it, and just let people dive into it. So the scientific community realized that, and the access to this type of data is reasonably well controlled. Of course, there are always issues about the boundaries and what can be published and what you have to pay attention to. And so this is a classical, let's say, European perspective that's in line also with EU regulations like the GDPR. Genetic data is sensitive data. And then you can open up the discussion, because there's also issues about stigmatization linked to genetic data, about crazy ideas about what genetics says about people and what it says about the worth of people. So there are also groups all across the world that might have stronger concerns about how genetic data is used, exploited, misused, by whom, for what end. And so there's a wide range of questions, you know, issues that are alive in the community are, for example, if we take Europe before going to the other side of the world, the Roma populations in Eastern Europe, you know, all the way to Germany and Western Europe, those are populations that have been historically stigmatized and are still stigmatized today, and that actually play an important role in genetic studies. And then you can question the fact that actually European science and Western science in general has benefited from studying those populations that do not have access to basic health care. And there are questions of justice there that emerge. And so the privacy issues and the justice issues cannot be taken completely apart, because it's only by enforcing your privacy that you retain some degree of control over your autonomy, and therefore you can inform some forms of justice on, you know, for yourself or your community. And then going even further, privacy issues raised in, you know, on the other side of the world. I looked a lot in China. Before that, I looked in Kuwait, where we saw genetic data be used as a form of social control. You know, forensic genetics is a set of technologies that are meant to solve horrible crimes, but they can be deployed on such a scale that they become a tool of social control. We are watching you. We are watching you with cameras. We are tracking your cars with the GPS, and we have your DNA. And so these tools of genetics are part of an arsenal of social control. So the range of issues surrounding privacy is very broad and cannot be viewed too narrowly about, you know, why do we need privacy? Why do we care about who has my genetic data? I think the main perspective is one of autonomy. Like, I don't want you to read my newspaper from over my shoulder. I don't want you to go through my stuff in my office, even if there's nothing there. Because when we are under constant surveillance, our autonomy shrinks. And this is something that's very strong also in European countries. There are cameras everywhere, and people don't realize how they are slowly losing autonomy because they are being monitored constantly. And of course, there are good applications of that, because, yeah, solving crimes is really important, and having cameras helps you solve crimes. Horrible rapes and murders need to be solved, so having DNA is good for that. But if those technologies are just deployed without any boundaries, then everybody, every day when they walk down the street, every interaction they have with another human being, they feel like they are being watched, they are being under surveillance, and they feel the need to comply. And what do we comply with? Well, we comply with the dominant social order. And so when we remove privacy, which is viewed in Europe very much as a personal right, we don't really realize to what extent actually we need privacy as a common good, as a social good. We need the privacy so that societies will have to tolerate those in societies that are pushing the boundaries and of the structures within society. So it can be LGBT activists, it can be people trying to protect migrants who travel across Europe, it can be green activists. All these groups need the privacy the most. So why do I need to protect my privacy, even, you know, if I'm a 50-year-old bourgeois who enjoys the privileges of European society? Because if I do not get privacy, then those who really need it will lose it. And therefore, we get into a mode of a very sclerotic society that cannot change anymore. And I think this is a view of privacy that is not perceived well enough. And for me, it's very, very important. Privacy is a common good so that actually we can have a society that is alive, that can change, that can evolve. With constant surveillance, without privacy, your society shrinks and becomes sclerotic.
That was very enlightening. Also, yeah, for me, because I always have trouble explaining the concept of DNA privacy and why it's important. So I always feel that it's very technical, and people's eyes glaze over and they get bored. Could you maybe just go back to the very basics? You said some points. Why is DNA data so special? I mean, what makes a difference from other personal data?
Yeah. So DNA data is special and not special. So it's a very interesting question because on the one hand, DNA data is really special because it's so unique. Your DNA, 3,000 small letters of the four DNA nucleotides form the unique code that you carry and that you only share almost identically if you have an identical twin. Otherwise, you don't share it for more than 50% with anybody else. So it has this kind of almost magic power of linking you to your identity. Who are you? DNA provides a very strong answer to that. You are your DNA. Now, we know that this is completely wrong. We know that we are not determined by our genes, that it's part of our heritage, that it's part of what we are going to be, that it can be the cause from some severe disease, that it can be linked to maybe some types of behaviors, but we are not cannot be reduced to our DNA. This is an important point because when we say that DNA is special, we tend to give it this magical power that, well, because it's special, it's you, it's everything. No, it's only part of who we are. But in a certain sense, yes, it is special because it's unique. It's really this thing that is in every cell and that we share with everybody without sharing it with anybody. So this dimension is important. Now, there is another dimension where DNA is much less special. So when we look at analysis, for example, for a disease, people will be worried that, well, by looking at my DNA, someone could know that I'm a risk of a certain disease, that I might be my risk of developing schizophrenia sometime in my life is 30% higher than somebody else. And because of that, we are very, very much afraid. Now, that same information might be in my medical record, and it might be much more valid because if I have received a certain diagnosis, it's there. That information is super, super sensitive. So sometimes we are in a weird position where we actually give to DNA more of a magical value than it really has in practice, where we need to safeguard sensitive information, might be about disease, might be about ethnic origin, might be about family secrets. You know, my DNA might tell that actually, you know, my father is not my biological father, for example, and maybe I want to learn that, or maybe I don't want to learn that, and maybe I want to learn that, but my sister doesn't want to learn that. So all these aspects are very complex, and I would say that DNA spans the spectrum from being very special to actually being quite boring, and you can't really pin it at one place.
I mean, you said that too, like people attributed this magical power, but this can become like a real, like just by people believing it.
Yes,
you can be discriminated because people think you know, there's research on political orientation.
Yeah, it's very broad, and in particular, everything that has to do with ethnicity is extremely concerning. So this is one of the grave concerns that I have in the long term, maybe not today, but as a community, because I'm part of the, you know, human genetic community, we want to build those maps of human genetic diversity. We want to know how people differ across the world and through history, because also the genetics of population is not fixed. We want to understand, I worked a lot around the Uyghurs, what makes the Uyghurs different from the Han Chinese and, let's say, the Turkish or Siberian populations, these genetic flows, how they come together. We want to know that. I'm not sure why. It's somewhat boring, but it seems to be fascinating scientists quite a bit. And we want to create those maps which are truly relevant for better understanding, for example, disease. But nobody, I feel, wants to admit that maps are dangerous objects, that maps are political objects, and that when you start drawing precise maps, there is always a point where someone starts to draw boundaries on maps and frontiers, and that can be extremely dangerous. And so we see that when we create those maps, we can use that for political goals, for discrimination, for deciding who someone is most deeply, most inherently, I'm not sure, intrinsically. We pretend that the genetics defines who you are at your inner core, which doesn't make any sense, but what people do. And so I'm very much afraid that if the community does not engage with this responsibility that we need those maps, we will not stop building them, unfortunately, or fortunately, we need those. But that we, because we want those maps, we need to accept that we have a responsibility towards society. And that when we see discourse that uses those maps in very stigmatizing and discriminating ways, then we, as scientists, have the duty to step towards society and say, well, this is beyond what is acceptable. 2 years ago, or so 2 or 3 years ago, there was this massacre in Buffalo in the United States. And the shooter there had a manifesto. And in this manifesto, there was genetics. So if you go and Google and search, you will find these horrible kind of silly discussions of genetics and race and why race is a thing. And it turns out that the shooter had actually made a reference to work by a scientist that was actually linked to a university in Brussels. And the university, when they realized that, they broke every affiliation they had with him. But this was a controversy in Belgium. How come that we have a scientist affiliated with the University of Brussels whose science, which was really questionable, was used as a pretext, at least in the thinking of the murderer, to actually kill people? And it turns out that the science was not at all neutral. It was really, some of the articles written were really problematic. One that I looked in more details was stating that because of studies of genetic diversity of human population, we should, rather than having one Homo sapiens species of humans, we should actually split it in two, with an African species and a European Asian species. And with a complete disregard for, indeed, all the social and political dimensions, where you have this kind of scientific reasoning, and this is a scientist with a scientific track record, so this is not something, someone completely crazy, this is published in a scientific journal published by a major scientific publisher, and you see, okay, there is something wrong here. How do we handle this? How come this gets published? How come that, you know, there's not a big controversy surrounding this? And we see that, yes, there are people out there who want to tie their identity and the identity of others to genetics, and they also want these identities to be organized in a hierarchical fashion, because, of course, they implicit message is, if we are two different species, is because, well, there are some better humans and maybe some less good humans. And so this kind of stigmatization, discrimination is something that is kind of inherent to the fact that we create the knowledge. And I think that we need this knowledge. We can't say we're not going to do any genetics anymore because there are some risks associated. But what we cannot do is pretend that we do the genetics, we do the good thing, and then there are some crazy people and they do crazy stuff, but that's not our problem. It has to be our problem because we want to give this information, this knowledge.
Yeah, I think it's very questionable if this genetic science can be neutral at all, because all the researchers, the scientists, they are still part of a colonial tradition. It is still in our history, it's in our minds, it's still in parts of our laws, and it's ongoing.
Yeah.
And it's still a reality nowadays, as sad as it is. And therefore, you still have to see all the connections to the world. And yeah, as you mentioned with the mapping, so if there's a map, somebody will use it. And therefore, you have to foresee that what you're searching, what your research, what's your outcome can be used. It might not be your intention, but it can be used. So therefore, yeah.
But do you think, you said this research needs to be done, but do you think there's some research that just shouldn't be done, or where do you draw the line? Because I think if data is there, then you can... I had this discussion with a scientist who said, oh, but we just need better science communication. We can explain statistics, we can explain how genetics works, and then people will understand that this is not... we are not saying someone is like this, but just they understand risks and stuff like this, and gradual gradients between groups. And But I think if someone wants to misuse data, then they don't care about good science communication. They will just take from it what they will, and yeah, and they will use this to communicate their own message to other people, who will then think, oh, this sounds scientific, great. You know, the sociologist Aaron Panofsky, who did research on white supremacists use genetic research to communicate within their community. And yeah, I see a kind of unsolvable dilemma in this.
Yeah, I mostly agree. So indeed, first of all, this is knowledge that is hard to communicate. So who has the patience of getting a mini genetics course for, you know, a day before they understand what the message really is? And we're faced with people who simply don't want to listen and will cherry pick scientific results, which are on a really broad scale. Some of it is legitimate science that gets misused, and some of it is actually biased science where you start from the conclusion, which we may often do as scientists, you know, I don't want, but where actually it's totally oriented. The conclusion is first given, and then you look for the data that allows you to move towards that conclusion, where the message is indeed oriented towards discrimination. White supremacists in the US are very keen on this type of genetic data. Sometimes it's also arising in surprising places. So, for example, Orthodox Jewish communities in Israel are also very keen on looking at genetic data to see who is a real Jew. So this is really problematic because it can be misused. I don't think that you can totally control the misuse, but you need to step in the debate. And I was very surprised to hear very recently of a major figure in the study of genetic diversity who, when he retired a couple of years ago, decided that he was going to go and engage with white supremacists on the internet.
Okay.
one of the most, good luck with that, but one of the most famous people in the field. So that he said, well, you know, I need to do something about that. What, it's not going to solve the problem, but at least it shows engagement. Whether there are things that we should not know, sometimes I feel that there might be a few things. Of course, I'm a scientist, so for me, knowledge is an end in and of itself, which, you know, might not be everybody's point of view, but I'm a scientist, this is how I function. But there are things where sometimes I say, well, do we really need to know that? So for example, very specifically, when I look at genetic diversity in China, the Tibetans, they live at 4,000 meters plus. They are physiologically adapted to high altitude. Those adaptations are reflected genetically. They have specific genetic adaptations that can be identified. It's a fascinating question from a biological perspective and also from a medical perspective. I mean, they process oxygen better, and there are lots of medical conditions that could be improved if we knew how we can help humans live better when they are struggling with processing oxygen properly. So it's very fascinating both as a fundamental biological question and as a medical question. However, understanding those genetic differences is extremely political because the control of the Tibetan plateau, which is a quarter of China. I mean, we think of Tibet as the Alps, but no, it's absolutely gigantic. It's a huge region. It is one that Chinese authorities absolutely want to control. It is one that is partly contentious. The border between China and India is still not completely fixed, and there are still conflicts between India and China about where the boundary, the border between the two countries lie. So Chinese authorities are sending colonists to control the Tibetan populations and the military to control the border. So they're sending a lot of people, but when you go and live above 4,000 meters for months or years on end, you will develop serious medical complications, at least some of the people. Cardiovascular problems, cognitive deficits. Babies born to Han couples in Tibet are half a kilo lighter than they should be, so this is a very stressful environment. And in the scientific literature, you can find articles that say, just one line or two, but it says it very explicitly, if we knew the genetic markers of adaptation to high altitude, then we could screen the Han settlers that we send to Tibet or the soldiers that we send to Tibet so that fewer of them have trouble living there, and they don't have to deal with a population that tends to get sicker than we would like them to. So knowing these genetic markers of adaptation to high altitude has directly political implications in the world of today. And so there sometimes I say, you know, how far should we go in that kind of research? How much cooperation should we have on certain populations like the Tibetan, like the Uyghurs? You know, when I discuss with colleagues of big international projects that want to map genetic diversity, I tend to say, it's okay if you look at the genomes of a few individuals, but if you start looking at the genomes of thousands of individuals of those populations in details, then maybe you have to worry about the political implications of your research. So maybe my position changed in the last 5 or 10 years, where in the past I would have been like most scientists and would say, well, knowledge first, and the society has to deal with any problems that stems from the research. Now, maybe willing to make some exceptions when I feel that there is no way for society to handle a certain type of knowledge properly. And I feel that, for example, you know, genetic diversity of Tibetan populations is one that is really problematic.
Yeah. I would just like to come back one step to the more systemic issue of publishing this knowledge. You already talked about language, that is an issue, but also, so most research is published in international journals and papers. Those journals usually have guidelines. They also have a review process. And that should be a process that detects data that is questionable. That should be a process that sees like, oh, there is no consent given for the information that is used. Do you think that that works properly? Or, well, I don't think so. So therefore, why doesn't it work properly? Yeah, so, or how could it be better?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how it could be better, because it's a very social question. But definitely we're facing with a horrible systemic failure. So it is particularly frustrating because all scientists who, for example, deal with genetic data, deal with patient data all over the world, have to face a lot of bureaucratic hurdles to handle this data. They have to obtain consent or find a proper basis for their research. They have to get approval from ethics committees. You know, scientists need hours and days to go through these processes. They might also become discouraged and work on something else simply because it's too complicated. So it costs millions and millions because it's the time of all these researchers. And then when you take an issue, like I looked in particular at research on vulnerable Chinese populations, the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the other Muslim minorities, you see systemic failures of these processes. They don't work when they should work the most. This is absolutely, you know, crazy, because we are discussing sometimes about, okay, did you get the consent of a patient in exactly the right way? You know, there might be a concern with this, a concern with that. And then when we have situations, if we take the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, crimes against humanity have been taking place in Xinjiang's camps, have been set up where people were arbitrarily detained for months, years, or simply vanished. Women have been subject to forced birth control, forced abortion. People have been sent into forced labor across the country. Children were taken for their families and sent into boarding schools so that they could be raised as good communist Chinese kids. So absolutely horrible crimes. And then you realize that there is a whole field of research that studies those populations very intensely. So the first element is that we saw that those populations that are the most vulnerable, the Uyghurs, the Tibetan, the other Muslim minorities, that they are studied much more intensely than what you would expect from their size of their population. To be concrete, The Uyghurs represent 1% of the population in China, but they were studied in the papers we looked at in 1 out of 5 papers. So really, scientists seem to be wanting to know what's going on with this group. And it happened to be a group that is actively persecuted. It was about the same with the Tibetans, who were studied even more intensely, 1 in 6 papers for 0.5% of the population. So why this super intense research? And also, in this research, we saw that 1/2 of the papers had a co-author from the Chinese police, the Ministry of Justice, or similar institutions. So it's very surprising that this kind of research would be published in Western journals. Now, people will say, well, before 2017, nobody had heard about the Uyghurs, nobody knew where Xinjiang was on the map. That may be true, but the Tibetans, which is a group that Europeans, Americans know very well is a group at risk, they have been studied just as intensely. And nobody seemed to have a problem with that. And so not only had this flown under the radar, and we're not talking about a couple of publications, we're talking about tens and hundreds of publications where there are issues not only with informed consent or ethical approval, but simply non-maleficence. This is research that is directly relevant to the deployment of a very specific technology in the field as a tool of social control. We're not talking about fundamental research and understanding the detail of your genetics. We're talking about validating kits for use by the police, and either directly that or the step right before it. So really directly relevant to the law enforcement, as they want to propose it, but social control in my mind. And when we approach the publishers, they seem very reluctant to do anything about it. So
yeah, and I can tell you from this perspective, since I'm from the publishing field, I used to work for a big German publishing house in India, because they send all their production of journal stuff into India. So you still have the editors, which are like sitting all over the world. But the publishing houses, where you have a system where every researcher, every scientist can upload their paper. You have these things, you have to click, yeah, there's a content, you have to attach a copy of that and stuff. But then you have like a group of people who are not from the field, who do the first check. So still there's a peer review process and so on. But since publishing is like a capitalist industry, people are publishing as much as possible and going on and on and on and always more. And there's always this idea of it has to be faster, it has to be done cheaper, it has to be quicker published. So therefore the quality actually is a problem. It's difficult to hold the quality of the published papers since, yeah, the pressure is so high. Yeah.
And I would say even major publishers have succeeded in an incredible disappearing act. So nobody realizes that these are major international businesses that have billions of dollars turnover for the biggest ones. And everybody seems to think that this is a small cottage industry by academics, while this is actually one of the most powerful industries in the world. And of course, when you point at systemic problems with the publishing system, then there is a reluctance to actually make waves and disturb the order and bring risks to basically the commercial purposes of this enterprise. And so looking at the problems with forensic research in China, you can ask, well, why is it so slow? Maybe because China is the major emerging market for Western publishers. It's growing at about 5% a year versus 1.5% in Western countries. And Chinese authorities are also extremely aggressive. So if you step on the toes of the Chinese authorities, they will push back violently. This is, for example, seen in scientific papers where there is often a sentence when it's about China or in some way possibly related to Taiwan, they would add a sentence saying that they don't take any positions regarding borders or countries, because of course we do not want to say that Taiwan might be a separate country from China, because that will invite serious retaliation. Springer Nature, for example, at some point accepted to censor some of its publications that they were accessed in China. So Chinese researchers could not access some of their publications. And then there was incredible pushback from the Western academic community who said, well, that's not possible. And then they had to turn around. And so they might be in a difficult place, but of course, in my view, they're mostly driven by profits. And every decision, where even when we talk about ethical decisions, seems to be subrogated to actually business interests. That is my view after interacting with that industry for 5 years.
Yeah. You already mentioned that you challenged some researchers, challenged some publishers, mentioning that there have questionable data in their research, in their articles, and you were successful at some parts.
Yes.
Some articles were taken back.
As of today, 31 research papers have been retracted. One on facial recognition, ethnic facial recognition. It was about predicting whether someone was Uyghur, Tibetan, or Korean based on their face, and then another 30 on genetics of Chinese populations. There is another 60 or so cases that are open, and it's only a subset of the entire set of problematic publications, which is maybe several hundreds up to 1,000 or so, that is questionable, probably impossible to get that number of retractions. However, retractions are a very strong academic signal. This is publications are the currency of academia. Having a paper retracted, I would say that scientists in European countries would prefer to pay a fine of 10,000 euros rather than having a paper retracted. This is something that kind of stings. So that set of retraction is a very visible signal across communities, in the forensic genetics community, in the human genetics community. So it's also very interesting, the relation between subfields. So forensic genetics is actually a part of human genetics that focuses on how to use genetic knowledge to identify individuals towards solving crimes. But that is, of course, taking all the knowledge that comes from human genetics, which is also very close to or connected to clinical genetics. How do we use genetics to diagnose rare disease or complex diseases? And those communities in the human and clinical genetics community, they have a huge need for public trust. And so the human and clinical genetics communities have been much more willing to address those problems. And so that has been a positive signal to see that, yes, there are scientists out there who actually, with all the limitations of their knowledge, because we are indeed not social scientists, we are very naive in many ways, have been willing to consider those issues and actually push back and tell, well, this is really a problem. So I've been invited multiple times at human genetics events to talk about these issues. So these communities have been very receptive, and other parts of the community have been much less receptive. And so it's a constant tension within the academic community. Also very important for people to realize that the scientific community is something absolutely huge, and it's not something homogeneous at all.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you your criticism had some good reception. And I was wondering whether sometimes you are also challenged as being too political or something, because I heard that from other people who criticize practices in the science community, that it can be difficult because they think you should be neutral. That means?
I hate that.
Objective.
Objective, neutral. I hate that. So we all come with a social and political baggage to the discussion, and I'll address that part first. So the notion that science must be objective. No, it's not absolutely wrong. We simply have to see that as a kind of horizon, and we walk towards the horizon and we never reach the horizon, because there is no such thing as true objectivity, because we all function in a human society. You know, you can even go down to mathematical logic, neurobiology. You actually will see that there are boundaries to our perception of reality. But of course, we want not to be too biased in our practices. We want to be reasonably honest and neutral, whatever that means. But I think that people have a big misunderstanding about what that is supposed to mean. Usually it means don't do politics and shut up. I mean, that is how I would summarize it. And very interestingly, this is in itself, in my view, a product of the science since the 1980s and the industrialization of science. So if you go back in history, let's take the Second World War, scientists took very political stances. They advocated for building the bomb during the war, and after the war, they advocated for trying to limit the risk of nuclear warfare. And we're not just talking about Einstein, we're talking about Bertrand Russell, one of the most famous philosophers and mathematicians of the 20th century. We're talking about biologists like Linus Pauling and many others. These scientists realized that they had a huge moral responsibility to society because they actually had brought nuclear weapons to the world. And they stepped into the social debate for about 20, 30 years, trying to control the risks of a nuclear holocaust. And so the idea that scientists by nature are apolitical creatures, I think it is very wrong and dangerous. So I think that the idea of a neutral look at science, I think it's not only an annoyance, but it's also the product of the industrialization of science. So if you look at how science changed from the beginning of the 20th century till now, you will see from the, I would say, the 1980s or so, that science became of major industrial relevance. High tech became the core of Western, or one of the core elements of Western society. And we shifted from, you know, a kind of amateurish science by rich, privileged people who could afford the time of building a career and travel across the world to actually an industrialization of science with a lot of resources, lots of grants that come together. And then as a scientist, we have to become more and more and more and more productive and actually publish. And that we kind of lose track of the fact that, well, as a scientist, yes, it's important to do good science. It's important that this good science gets known, but it's also important to think. And what has disappeared in the last 50 years in science is that I think there is a lot less time to think than 50 years ago because of this industrialization scale-up of science. And the notion that you need to be objective, I think, is linked to that. And it actually does not naturally correspond to a scientific mindset, I think. And this is something that's completely forgotten when you address scientists and say, yeah, wait, the story of objectivity, let's try to put that back in context. People are actually very surprised. Oh, you mean that I want to be objective because I do capitalist science? Well, yeah, to some extent, I would say this is part of the explanation, yes. The other part of the question, by now I've forgotten the first part.
No, if you get, and you yourself maybe get challenged.
So my challenge as being too political. Not so much. I think that I'm an extremely polite person. Which doesn't mean that I don't express sharp standpoints, but I will always do it in a respectful way. And I think that the combination of this, of being perceived as a hardcore scientist, you know, not humanities, you know, I'm an engineer, you know, yes, working on biology, and you know, having a reasonably high social status and being in a position of privilege, I think these things have so far, limited this kind of pushback, because people cannot say, oh, you don't understand the science, because if they say that, they're going to get themselves in trouble.
You will prove them wrong.
Yeah, so, and if they would say that I'm too political, I think that I would be able to handle this kind of criticism as well. I think that I'm in this very unusual position of being an insider and not having pushed myself yet outside the field, of having, by also being slow and building connections inside the community, I was also, I think, so far, always put the caveat so far, able to avoid being in an isolated position. Mm-hmm. It might change. You never know where the pushback could come from. You know, I'm a bit concerned that at some point, you know, there would be attacks on my reputation. That could happen. So that is part of the risk that I'm willing to take. It has not occurred so far, and I'm trying to manage that risk as much as I can.
I hope it won't happen so soon or not at all. Yeah, I really like the point that you're from your position, which, as you said yourself, a privileged position, but that you focus on the positive side of combining these social questions into hard science. Yeah. Because I feel this is quite often still like it's a bias. So it's either this or that. And or if you try to see it, like combine it to see, yeah, how can we learn from each other? It often has like a negative touch, like, it softens the hard science. It doesn't do them good somehow.
Yeah, so there is a huge cultural issue. It's very hard to change. This is one of the things on which I would want to work in the future, and that is that there is this culture in the hard sciences of seeing, you know, the hard sciences as the serious stuff, and the humanities, the people who speak all day long, who talk all day long, who contradict each other all day long. That culture is extremely strong. I'm not saying it's every hard scientist like that, but the reality is that this is very, very strongly embedded in the culture, that there are gaps in language that make, you know, crossing that boundary difficult, that there are gaps in how you perceive the world. So as a technical person, because I really have that background, realizing that when, let's say, somebody works on an algorithm, not necessarily my algorithms, but somebody works on an algorithm, and that it gets deployed in society, that means that this algorithm now has a political dimension. Architecture is politics, as Lessig said, and actually perceiving this reality is very hard for many people in the hard sciences. We see it very much in the discussions of artificial intelligence today. The level of perception of the realities of society is absolutely abysmal. You think these people are, you know, some of those are among the richest and most influential people in the world, and the way they talk about the impact of what they do on society is beyond naive. And I think this is really the result of this lack of culture in a huge segment of society. We're not talking about the small thing. We're talking about many percents of the society where people work around technology and the development and deployment of technology. It's a big part of society that is actually totally naive about the play in which they are playing. So we need to change that. And of course, it's going to be very hard because this gap is there. What gives me a bit of hope is the fact that the younger generation, of course, I'm 50 plus, so I grew up in a very different world than people who are 20, 30 today. And when I see my student, when I talk to my student, I realize that they live in a different world than the one I grew up in, and that they are faced with, first of all, environmental questions. I mean, when we talk about engineering, for example, they're faced with social questions that, I grew up in the time where we still worried that the Russians would bomb us, so it's not like it was the nicest of times either. But today, the political instability of the world overall is such that this generation, I feel, is much more willing to question the practices of science and technology. I teach a small module to students, and in the beginning I was worried about, will the students be really interested to hear an engineer talk about ethics? And it turned out that the students are absolutely demanding. They really want to know more about that. And this is students that are bioinformaticians, so they're somewhere between biology and data science. And you can see that this is a generation that says, we cannot just move forward business as usual. That is not possible. So I think there is a huge opportunity with a younger generation that is actually interested in science and technology, but realizes that, well, we have to rethink how we approach science and technology.
Yeah. Let's really hope that our podcast reaches this younger science, because this is exactly what the Gene Ethical Network tries to manage, to find a way to combine these ethical questions that are coming with technical possibilities, just because something is possible, because the technical interventions are moving on. Do we really want that? This ethical question behind it should always be asked, because otherwise we cannot go back at some point.
Yeah, also like the how technology becomes embedded in society and creates its own structures, that is something that most tech people don't understand. They don't understand that they are every day building the social structures, because everything regulates human behavior. How humans interact is mediated very much by technology.
Yeah. And thank you so much for doing your part in it, for being so critical, talking to us today. And
well, that's very much my pleasure. It's been a long journey for me, but one that has been incredibly rich. And so I'm very, very thankful for the opportunity to talk to you two today.
Thank you so much.
Das war das Gespräch von Isabel Bartram und Janina Johansen vom Genethischen Netzwerk mit dem Bioinformatik-Professor Yves Moreau. Mehr zu seiner Person und zu den angesprochenen Themen findet ihr in unseren Shownotes und auf unserer Webseite www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Wenn ihr Feedback für uns habt oder Fragen, schickt uns die gern per E-Mail an podcast@gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Das Genethische Netzwerk ist ein gemeinnütziger Verein. Wir sind für unsere unabhängige kritische Arbeit, zu der auch dieser Podcast gehört, auf Spenden von Einzelpersonen angewiesen. Also, wenn euch diese Folge gefallen hat, lasst uns doch als Dankeschön eine kleine Spende da. Das geht ganz einfach online unter www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de/spenden. Danke und bis zum nächsten Mal.